It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as I begin the program, do want to remind you, do not hesitate to reach out and make a phone call, 252-826-9050, 726-9050. Go online to harvellandcollins.com. And their address, by the way, I need to at least mention that at least once, is 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City, across from Morehead City Town Hall. Really beautiful location, I might add. Gentlemen, good afternoon to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
Wow. Last week, we discussed the elective share, the spouse's right in the state of North Carolina to elect a share of their spouse's estate. And this is a statutory right that is codified in the North Carolina statutes. It comes at Wes and myself and other good lawyers, you know, from every direction. Sometimes we're representing the surviving spouse who is entitled to make an elective share. Sometimes we're defending the elective share that has been filed in the clerk of court. Sometimes, and interestingly, Lockwood, we have had files where the surviving spouse is a person of advanced age and is unable to really handle their legal affairs in a strong and forthright manner, and therefore it is their affairs are being handled through their agent under a power of attorney. And believe it or not, the agent under a durable power of attorney could likely have the right to assert the elective share. And this is something that Wes and I and other lawyers at our law firm are very careful to analyze and observe and to point out to clients. For instance, Lockwood, sometimes at the kitchen table, husband and wife will agree that they're in a second marriage, they have children from a prior marriage. You, my dear, have all of your assets. You, of course, my husband, have all of your assets. And we both agree that everything will pass to our respective children. And so now let's go to our good lawyer and have this documented in a last will and testament. So the client comes in and asserts that they, even though this elective share statute exists, and even though maybe they have they know of it, well, that will never happen in our file, Mr. Harvell, because we have agreed that our assets are going back to our children. And my wife will never assert that statute. And the wife chimes in and says, and that's correct. See, so my husband will never assert that statute because we've agreed otherwise. And we're married. We trust each other. Well, the dilemma with this conversation, Lockwood, is that suppose either this husband or this wife were to become infirm in some way in their advanced years, and then, of course, one of them dies, and the right to assert this elective share now falls to the power of attorney, who likely could be a child from a prior marriage or some other agent, and they then assert the elective share. And sometimes when the agent is a professional, we had a file in our office where it actually happened to be another lawyer, a good lawyer. That lawyer felt on behalf of his client, where he was serving as an agent under their power of attorney, that he really had no choice but to elect this elective share. So I know that I'm in a bit of a crack and a crevice here in explaining all of this, Lockwood, this afternoon, but just suffice it to say that this is an issue that Wes and I deal with very regularly, and it can come at us, the ball can be thrown at us from several different directions, and so we have to be very, very clued in, very keen to this elective share statute.
I appreciate the fact that you are saying this basically is, in your description, a crack in a crevice, that it's a nuance, but really it's more than a nuance because obviously you've experienced this. You keep using the term asserting elective share. So it requires the action or a decision on the part of the beneficiary of that elective share. Am I correct on that? It just doesn't automatically kick in. It requires an action on the part of the, I'm going to use the word, the beneficiary?
Sure. That's filing a claim, basically. You're filing a petition for your elective share claim. We touched on this a little bit last week. It doesn't happen automatically. In the event that the person is a surviving spouse, and obviously being a surviving spouse, they're married to the person who died. They have a 6-month period of time in order to file their petition for elective share with the clerk of court where the estate is pending. And it's 6 months from the date of the qualification of the personal representative of the estate. Mm-hmm. So you have to do that. If you, in the event you don't file that within 6 months, then that's a waiver of the elective share. As Cecil was mentioning, you know, I agree completely with him that, you know, folks come in, especially this is more of a second marriage type situation where it becomes a problem, or third marriage or fourth, or just not the first marriage, where it becomes a problem in most cases. It can become a problem just with your typical, you know, one marriage, two kids, you know, situation. But, you know, normally if you have, you know, one marriage, then husband will leave everything to wife, or wife will leave everything to husband upon the death. And then all the assets will then flow down to the children, maybe equally, maybe not, but they have the parents or the husband and wife, they have an interest in most cases to take care of their kids. But things change in the dynamic of this entire, you know, analysis with regard to that changes when you have a second marriage and their kids from a previous marriage.
Right.
Because there's still an interest in most cases for the first to die to take care of the second to die. Mm-hmm. The surviving spouse normally is going to receive, you know, the assets of the marriage and have the access to those during his or her lifetime. And then upon that person's passing, you know, even if they have, you know, wills in place that say, I leave everything to each other, and then upon the second to die's death, then all the assets will be divided equally among all of the children.
Right.
The husband's children and the wife's children, or something like that. And that's the way it's set up. Well, the surviving spouse, you know, can be in a situation where, you know, in the event that they're trying to, the first to die ends up in a situation where the surviving spouse is left a little bit less, then she can, you know, maximize that recovery through the elective share.
Right.
And as what Cecil was referring to a moment ago was that, you know, even though you have kind of a I love you situation and that's the way it's going to go, you may have a situation where you have the power of attorney for someone who's infirm to make that elective share claim that really just disrupts the estate plan that folks think they have in place, because that's just the statutory right. So the next question about that will be, okay, I want to provide for my surviving spouse, but based on the circumstances, I don't want to, you know, leave her everything because I do have children and I want to make sure that the children are taken care of when I die, the first to die.
Right.
And I want to make sure she's taken care of, but this elective share claim situation just puts me in a spot where, you know, she has that right to make that claim. Well, there's planning that you can put in place. And basically the planning controls what assets are left for the surviving spouse for the elective share. And you do that through the use of a trust. It's an elective share trust. So
instead of there being more of an election as to what assets are used for the elected share, the assets pass, you can identify what assets, you know, pass into a trust for the surviving spouse. For example, you can say that I leave, you know, the house in trust, or I leave this property, or I leave this money, and it goes in trust for that surviving spouse. And then there's a guarantee that those assets are there for the surviving spouse, but upon her death, or his death, then they pass out as indicated in the trust. So that kind of takes me full circle to what I was mentioning a moment ago. You know, when you have a situation where you've got the first to die, and then you have the second to die, and the assets are a large portion of the assets are left to the surviving spouse, which certainly can be, you know, ramped up and made a higher amount by the elected share claim. Well, I mean, we all know that the surviving spouse can change his or her will and leave those assets wherever they want to, and leave out the first to die's, you know, children, mm-hmm. for example. I mean, we know that can happen. That's where trust come into play in many cases. And then the elective share trust really kills two birds with one stone, because you're addressing the fact that we recognize that the elective share is going to allow the surviving spouse to ramp up how much she gets from my estate, to get more than what I had directed. So I can control what that is, and then I can guarantee that what's left in that elective share trust, with some, you know, we can put some limitations on as well, as far as whether you can sell the property, that kind of thing, is going to pass out as I direct, meaning the first to die is direct.
We've been talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins about the issue of elective shares, and also now, as we're hearing, a few other additional nuances associated with it and the value of an elective share trust. If you do divvy up the assets in a trust, we talked about this earlier, as a matter of fact, the previous program, on how the assets are divvied up based on the years of marriage. This is, of course, assuming a second marriage, okay? And if they've been married for 5 years, as I recall, it was like 15%, and then 5 to 10 years, 25%. As you put these assets into the trust, do you have to accommodate those percentages?
Well, the trust dictates to the executor slash trustee that thou shalt, if you will, set aside an amount equal to the elective share, pursuant to the elective share statute.
Gotcha.
So that is what would feed into or pour into the trust, would be the statutory amount. Now, Lockwood, we can change that. I mean, we can alter the language, but the formula generally, and estate planning does utilize what we lawyers call formulas, a lot of things, tax formulas and different formulas, and here comes another formula with regard to my executor shall compute the amount applicable under the elective share statute and pour that over to a trust for the benefit of the spouse. And so it would track more or less the statute. That's the general answer to your question.
Okay. All right.
So there's flexibility in the document, because you're right. We don't know, you know, obviously when we're going to die. Therefore, we don't know how many years we're going to be married at the time of death. So it's based on that. It's calculated.
Correct. In other words, what Wes is saying, Lockwood, is that that's the beauty of a formula. You see, in that we don't say, you know, 15%, 25%, 50%. We ask our executor to calculate what the percentage is based on the law at the time of the death of the first to die, and then and the formula would then dictates that we determine what the percentage is, and then that is how the trust is funded. And this is a similar thing from an estate tax standpoint, where the executor is to compute the value of the estate. And if for some reason the estate exceeds the exemption equivalent of the estate tax, then of course that particular amount goes into, you know, a trust. So formulas are a good thing that we lawyers use in estate planning. And this a sort of elective share trust utilizes such a formula.
Okay. All right.
Now, Lockwood, and go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, so in other words, Lockwood, Wes is correct. We don't know. I mean, when the clients, in fact, many times that's the case. I have a file, I think just yesterday, where they have just recently gotten married, in the last 2 or 3 years. Well, I mean, we don't have a heck of a lot of a percentage right now.
Right.
But my goodness, these folks are fairly young. They're very happy in their marriage, thank goodness, and I think that's wonderful. And the bottom line is we hope and pray that they will have a 15-year marriage. They're certainly counting on it or even longer.
Right.
And therefore, it's very likely that the 50% percentage is going to eventually, not now, but eventually would apply to their estates.
Mm-hmm.
And so we lawyers have to anticipate that.
Wow.
And that is, of course, why their documents will now utilize the formula that sets forth whatever the amount happens to be at the time of the death of the first is poured over to the elective share trust.
Okay. All right.
So there are situations in the elective share calculations and going through this process, as we touched on last week, where the clerk of court is going to have to enter orders requiring certain things to happen in order to pay the elective share.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you understand the money just doesn't fall from the sky to pay this claim. In many cases, there's quite a process you have to go through. You know, for example, let's say that the at a hearing, the elective share calculation is made, and that amount is, you know, $200,000, okay? And that's the amount that has to be paid in order to satisfy this elective share claim.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's say that the estate doesn't have $200,000 in it.
Right.
So where are we going to get the money from to pay the claim? Well, there can be assignment of assets. There can be we get into a valuation issue there,
mm-hmm.
as far as like what's the value of the asset that's being assigned. Because interestingly, I'm really going to get into the weeds right now. I want to try not to, but you understand that at the elective share calculation, as far as what's the value of all the assets in the estate and non-probate assets for purposes of calculating the total amount, that is all of the elective share. That's done at the date of death.
Right.
We're valuing real estate. We're valuing, what's the amount of, what's the stock, value of stock.
Right. Yeah.
Or the stock account show, IRA, all these things day to day. But then as far as paying the elective share amount, it may take a matter of months, if not longer, to actually get to a point where you have a hearing, the court decides and concludes this is the amount of elective share, and then the payment of it might be much later than the date of death. But it can't, let's say that we have an asset that is worth much less now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that sounds like, how would you have that?
Well, market.
You probably would have that situation where, I mean, let's say that one of the assets was a promissory note or a contract right, and the statute of limitations expired on it, and you can't collect it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the date of death, it was worth X amount of dollars, but now it's basically worth nothing because you can't collect on it because you waited too long. So we have to pay that from other assets because the elective share claim still has to be paid because that determination has been made. So if we don't have the money in the account or in the elective share or in the estate, and therefore, there's nothing to pay it with. And let's say that some other assets passed out. Let's say that some life insurance passed out to, four kids or something. Well, the clerk has the authority to claw that back, to enter orders requiring that to be paid back. The clerk has the right to enter a judgment. That's one of the very few areas where the clerk of court has the right to enter a money judgment against someone. In the event they don't pay, the clerk has the right to, let's say there's a piece of real estate, to enter an order requiring the sale of the real estate in order to pay, to generate the liquidity to pay the elective share. Now, the clerk is not going to just do these things summarily. The attorney for the petitioner, the person claiming the elective share, mm-hmm. is going to, you know, kind of file, well, it's going to file motions with the court for the proper relief, but the clerk has to follow the statutes as to what he or she can and cannot do regarding the payment of the elective share. And every step of the way, when we have these motions and we have hearings, we have an order, then when the order is entered, parties that are interested in that order through the clerk of court have a right to file an appeal. And that appeal goes up to the superior court. So the appeal track is clerk of court, superior court, and then what the superior court's job is by statute is to review the court's order and to review the record, which is like a transcript of what transpired at the hearing, to determine if the findings of fact are supported by the record mm-hmm. and the conclusions of law are supported by the findings of fact, just to make sure that the clerk did not abuse his or her discretion. So it's not like we're appealing. It's a little different, than an appeal, obviously, up to the North Carolina Court of Appeals. I mean, that's a more laborious, protracted type situation. It takes longer. But still, there's oversight with regard to what the clerk does or does not do. But the Superior Court can't substitute its opinion for the clerk. The clerk has discretion and has the right to make discretionary decisions. But the Superior Court on appeal basically makes sure that the evidence is there to support what the clerk did and that the law is followed.
In essence, it's a pass-fail situation. They either approve it or disapprove it.
That's a good way to put it.
Okay.
Yeah. And if they disapprove it, they don't say, okay, Madam Clerk, I am reversing your order and I'm entering my own order. Go do it this way. No, what they're saying is that they're remanding it back to the clerk for the clerk to enter further orders consistent with the ruling. So it's a remand back to the clerk. It just goes back. So that's kind of the process. But you could see that that could drag out over a period of time.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
That could take some time if it becomes, contentious. And really, the executor is the person who has the responsibility for making sure that the elective share is paid.
Mm-hmm.
That's the person who's making the election with regard to what assets are we going to pay it with. But then in the event that doesn't happen, then the petitioner can come forward with a motion, either removing the executor or asking for other, relief from the clerk of court. So it's, certainly can be somewhat of a hotbed for litigation over these things, which we try to avoid. When you're on the side where you're filing the petition for the elective share
mm-hmm.
and you're proceeding forward, in many cases you're representing someone who is entitled to something that they didn't realize that they were entitled to.
Right.
I have to tell you that it's kind of rare in the elective share filing world that the client comes in and says, hey, Mr. Collins, I'm hiring you for purposes of filing an elective share.
Mm-hmm.
That's normally not the way it happens. Contrast that with, hey, Mr. Collins, I'm hiring you for purposes of doing a closing. I'm buying a piece of property. Clients come in, they know what that's about. They understand they need an attorney for that. Where an elective share claim normally comes up is that the client's coming in, they're concerned because they know that there's some things that they probably need some legal advice on. They don't know what those things are, but they understand that obviously their spouse passed away. Maybe they're having some trouble with the children, the children from a previous marriage. And then the attorney in many cases is identifying, we're within 6 months, and it's appropriate for us to file an elective share for you. We're letting that person know about it, and then we're going through the process for them and helping them with it. So they're normally in a position where they're receiving something that they did not really even anticipate, you know, coming their way. Now, contrast that with the other side. I do want to contrast this quickly, mm-hmm. that we represent states all the time where elective share claims are being made, and we're on the side of having to pay the elective share.
Right.
Now, when you're on that side, many times you're dealing with children from a previous marriage who may not be very happy mm-hmm. about the fact that, oh, my goodness, my dad had a will. He left her something. But now you're telling me that she's entitled to more? That's not really the best, you know, that's not really where these folks want to be. They don't want to, in many cases, pay the second spouse, third spouse, whatever it may be, more than what, say, the father actually left. But you know what? It's kind of one of those situations where you just have to follow the law. You just have to, you have to advise your client, look, I understand it. I understand that this is not exactly where you want to be, but there's no way around this. You know, we will analyze this closely. We'll make sure that not, you know, too much is not paid, but you have to do it. There's no reason to make this, you know, too much of a fight.
Right.
There's a provision in the statute that allows the clerk of court to apportion attorney's fees and costs as he or she deems appropriate. So, if we represent an estate and there's an elective share claim, and even though the surviving or the children of the deceased aren't real happy about having to stroke a big check to pay an elective share claim, we've got to do that, because the big risk is that if you frustrate this process unnecessarily,
right.
you try to make it too difficult, then you could get popped for the attorney's fee.
Right.
You can get popped for the cost. And the clerk has every right to do that, and the clerk should do that, because this is a situation where the statute is pretty well laid out. It's pretty clear. It's really an exercise of math, of just identifying the assets and applying the percentage, and therefore it should be something that should not be drawn out, you know, for months and months, or over maybe a year or longer. Is something that really should be done in good faith. And if it's not, then there is that provision that the clerk can assess attorney's fees against the estate,
right.
or remove the executor for not following the statute.
You know, we get the question all the time, when do I have my estate looked at? When do I need to consult with a lawyer? When do I even need to think about
right.
these things?
And mm-hmm.
and today is a classic example of the general rule. When there are significant events in your life, you know, the death of a spouse, the remarriage, a divorce, you know, the death of a child, anything that the twists and turns of life, we have to understand, Lockwood, that with those twists and turns come legal consequences.
Mm-hmm.
When we lose a spouse, when we decide to get remarried, when we decide to adopt a child, when we decide to have a child, when, God forbid, we lose a child, these are significant life events. And with those significant life events, everyone then needs to have the opportunity to consult with an attorney.
And I would say, as we wrap it up, we've said this many times before, Cecil, and of course, obviously, we think in terms, first and foremost, of the dollar sign, the money, the cost. But there's also the cost of time, and then all I think a significant issue is the emotional cost, the cost of stress and difficulties that come as a result of and not having a clear path. And I just want to commend you and Wes. And again, that's Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins with us this afternoon here on Let's Talk Legal. It's a simple matter. Make a phone call. 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. Or if you want, go online to Harvell and Collins. You'll see the complete lineup of their staff and their services there at Harvell and Collins. Spell it the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Cecil, Wes, thanks for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Lockwood.